Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
It's a new record for payrolls for all the wrong reasons. Welcome to the Tuesday edition as the Bureau of Labor Statistics posts the biggest ever downward revision in job growth for a year. We'll get the latest ahead from Bloomberg's Washington correspondent Tyler Kendall with insights from Republican Senator Roger Marshall of Kansas. He'll be with us live from Capitol Hill, a doctor who can also weigh in on policy on a number of different scores, including changes at the CDC. We'll get into all of that ahead. Israel conducts an unprecedented strike against Hamas in Qatar. This just happened a couple of hours ago. The White House did get a heads up, and we'll discuss the implications with Aaron David Miller at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Our panel is together today. Bloomberg Politics contributors Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano along for the ride. And we start, as I mentioned, with the breaking story here from BLS. We knew it was coming. We just didn't know how large it would be. This is a preliminary estimate. So when you read stories about this, it's going to look like it's written in the future tense. BLS suggesting that it will be the biggest downward revision of all time. And it's a pretty fat number. 911,000. We have been getting a bit of a response from the White House at this relatively early hour in the day. There's a press briefing and a couple of presidential events later where I suspect we'll hear a lot more. But let's get right to Tyler Kendall, who's with us in studio here in our Washington bureau. 911,000, Tyler. The White House says this proves Donald Trump was right.
Right, exactly. And you really hit the main point here, which is that U.S. job growth was far less robust in the year through March, which only encounters the first 3 months of the Trump administration than previously reported. And this is, of course, putting mounting pressure on the Federal Reserve. But it's also helping to mount that pressure by the White House, which is now using this, kicking out this statement to us reporters here in Washington, really less than an hour after these revised numbers came up, saying in part that the BLS released the largest downward revision on record, proving that President Trump was right. Biden's economy was a disaster and the BLS is broken. Of course, this leans really heavily into the administration's argument that at this point, Joe, we've heard for months. But it's important for us to mention that while the president has been really critical of these revisions, both monthly and now the benchmark adjustments, economists say that there's a few different reasons here as to why we've seen in recent years such large changes. And part of it has to do with the response rate that the BLS is getting, and part of it has to do with a change in conditions after the pandemic. And I think sort of that context helps to lay the scene here just a little bit more. Now, of course, one of the big questions here is how is the administration going to talk about this going forward when they're pushing this new BLS commissioner? Important to note right now, there's an acting commissioner at the BLS, a career employee. He's been there since 2015. He served in this role actually on an acting capacity before, because we are waiting for the Senate to take up the nomination of E.J. Antoni. Right. And he, of course, as you well know, is the chief economist at the Heritage Foundation, considered to be a conservative organization based here in Washington.
It'd be very interesting to witness this confirmation process. Tyler, thank you so much. Tyler Kendall, off the North Lawn of the White House for a moment to walk through these numbers here. As we prepare to add the voice of Senator Roger Marshall, I just want to mention that before this report, to have a sense of what the baseline was, the government's payroll data showed employers adding nearly 1.8 million total jobs for that period, the year through March. An average of 149,000 a month, which if you follow this stuff and you listen to this program would sound pretty normal, right? A buck 50 on a monthly jobs report would be considered fair to middling, depending on the expectations. This revision shows average monthly job growth was half that. And so surely the senator has some thoughts on this, and he will be involved in dealing with the next BLS commissioner. Roger Marshall, a Republican, and I should note, a doctor as well, a physician from the great state of Kansas, joining us live from Capitol Hill. Senator, great to have you back on Bloomberg. It's good to see you. What's your thought on a downward revision that sets a record beyond 900,000? Do you believe these numbers that we just got today?
Well, Joe, I don't know what to believe, but certainly on paper, we lost nearly a million jobs from Joe Biden's failed economy. This is why I've been so frustrated for the past year trying to bring attention to this, that doing it the same old way doesn't work, and there's no excuse. I don't care if they blame it on COVID, it's post-COVID. There's absolutely no excuse when you're trying to legislate, when you're in the White House trying to make a decision, the Fed's trying to make a decision on interest rates. You need good data. Yeah. You know, the BLS is responsible for inflation numbers and new jobs numbers. So it just makes our job next to impossible, and that's why President Trump fired the current BLS administrator, and now we need somebody new, and that's why I think that Dr. EJ Antoni will be a great new member to come in there and turn that place upside down and start over.
Okay, so it sounds like you're ready to vote yes.
No, I am. I met with Dr. Antoni. He really did impress me. I asked him how he's going to do this, and there's several problems. One is how they collect the data, and then how do they interpret it as well. So the small businesses are definitely being underrepresented here. We need to introduce some type of software to a package where every business at the end of the month when you're doing your finances, you can just check one box, write in how many numbers of jobs you added or subtracted, and that automatically goes to the BLS. So there's a lot of things that he can do.
Well, okay, that's a good start, because there are a lot of questions about what actually needs to be done as opposed to moving people around. And there have been some people moving, Senator, as you well know. Bloomberg's Molly Smith has a big story out today about staffing issues at the BLS. Of course, that starts with the commissioner. But at this point, a third of high-level roles are currently vacant. How do you fix BLS? How do you improve the quality of data when there's nobody in the building?
Well, look, I think this is a great news. We need to start over. No different than when you fire the head coach. It's great that all the assistant coaches leave as well. We need to create a brand new culture. The only thing worse than no data is bad data. If we don't have any answers, then we'll keep flying by the seat of our pants. So I think that this is good news, and we can go in there and hire the people that are more willing to break that cultural prototype the way they've been doing it.
Interesting. Does this really come down to the response rate, Senator? Is it as simple as that? Because that's the stock answer. You know what? Employers just aren't compelled to respond to the government the way they used to be. Sometimes we get 40%. It's hard to put a real number on that. Or are there other factors inside the organization that need to be hit?
Yeah, so I don't think there's one magic bullet, but I was surprised to find out that part of the data, the Census Bureau was out there also gaining information from households. So I am worried about when one agency collects the data, 15 different hands touch it, then it goes over to BLS and other people touch that data as well. All I know is right now the system's broken. We need to start over. And I think that there's a technology solution to a lot of this. And I can't write that program, but I'm sure there's businesses out there that are going to make a good living on getting this technology right.
Well, absolutely. I suspect that there'll be some interesting news if Mr. Antoni gets the job and gets rolling on all of this. Interesting news on who might be hired and how these contracts are doled out. Senator, I have to remind everybody, as I said in the outset here, that you're a physician and you're Doc Marshall to a lot of folks on Capitol Hill. So we were paying close attention in that hearing with RFK Jr. last week. You've delivered 5,000 babies in your career, which I found incredible to learn about you today, Senator. And here you find yourself working alongside 99 babies in the Senate, which is something to think about as well. Are you concerned? I saw you in that hearing. I don't know what you're laughing at right now, but I saw you in that hearing with Secretary Kennedy. Do you worry about the loosening of guidelines around COVID vaccines?
I don't actually. I think the whole goal of Secretary Kennedy is to bring transparency and trust back to the CDC. That Secretary Kennedy, myself, we believe in parents, that you can make your own decisions for your children, that not every person needs every vaccine. And I think the COVID vaccine is very controversial. There's people I would recommend it for. There's other that the benefits don't outweigh the risk, that by now we've all had COVID four or five times, we have our own natural immunity. And I think the emphasis here is we want to give all the truth, all the transparency to parents, to doctors, to whoever the adults are in the room that are making that decision, and then do their very best with that, because not a vaccine is a drug. I am concerned about 76 jabs. I'm not sure any child needs 76 jabs between birth and the time they're old enough to vote.
How about mRNA? There seems to have been a cloud over this technology since Secretary Kennedy moved into Health and Human Services. A lot of folks think it's the answer, that it could in fact bring a cure for cancer. How should we be thinking about mRNA technology aside and separate from COVID, Senator?
Right. So I do think there's the opportunity for other uses of this vaccine, and I have every faith that the private sector is going to take this technology and run with it. We have spent billions and billions, tens, maybe hundreds of billions on this mRNA vaccine, but what we know is it's very short-lived. The type of process it is, it only builds up immunity for several months. I think instead we should turn a focus to antivirals. We've learned from our friends over our veterinarians that vaccines seldom work. You can't quite make one quick enough, but if we had an antiviral, that would be working. And more importantly, we need to be addressing our own immune system to respond to these viruses. You think about who COVID killed, it was people with diabetes, people whose immune systems weren't right. So I think through proper nutrition, exercise, healthy lifestyles, we can build up our own immunity as well. There's a place for vaccines. Don't get me wrong. I think the polio vaccine was incredible. MMR, DTaP. I think there's some really good vaccines out there, but not every person needs every vaccine.
Where are you on the department? Do you still trust the HHS to provide guidance specifically to children to keep them healthy?
Absolutely, I do. And I think that we're going to say when we don't know, we don't know. And I think there's so much we truly don't understand. We don't understand the interaction of these 76 jabs, how it impacts that immune system going forward. I'm glad that we can start talking to parents. Why does your baby, who needs a hepatitis vaccine on day number one? And if I could, you know, like you said, I delivered a baby most every day for 25 years of my life. We tested every one of those moms for hepatitis. If she was negative, she's not doing IV drugs, she's in a stable, monogamous relationship, she's not living with anybody with hepatitis, there's zero chance that baby is going to get hepatitis when it's born. On the other hand, there's some other babies that do need that hepatitis vaccine. I just want to inform parents, give doctors good information as well, and then let them make that decision whether they think their baby needs a hepatitis vaccine on day number one. We have no idea what it's doing to that baby's immune system.
Doctor, what's the prescription for funding the government? Are we going to shut down at the end of the month? It looks like there are fewer than a dozen legislative days here, and I feel like you've seen this movie before.
Yeah, we have. We might as well just do the continuing resolution, the short gap measure today. Chuck Schumer's never going to let us take that funding through the floor, the appropriate process. My hat's off to Senator Susan Collins, the chairperson of that Appropriations Committee. She has 8 of the 12 buckets of money done through committee, super majorities, but Chuck won't let his people free to vote for that on the floor. So we might as well do the continuing resolution, then let's get on with nominations and other very important matters.
You go through the end of the year and do a full year CR, just bite the whole thing off.
Yeah, that we're going to wrist wrestle about that all day long. I would sure like for it to go through to next January or February, but I don't see the Democrats giving in on that. We'll wrestle about how long that's going to last. I would probably take a year-long one because I think in the day that's less spending for the federal government.
Yeah, I think the White House might agree with you on that, Senator. Thank you for coming back to talk to us, as always. Dr. Roger Marshall, the Republican from Kansas, and a member of the U.S. Senate with us here on Balance of Power. Thank you, sir. We're going to have much more ahead as we turn to geopolitics in our conversation with Aaron David Miller, only here on Bloomberg.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Thank you for being with us on the Tuesday edition of Balance of Power here on Bloomberg Radio. We're on the satellite radio Sirius XM channel 121, and you can watch the show on Bloomberg Originals now every day, as well as on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Business News Live, and we'll meet you in the studio with a remarkable story coming from overseas today. Another use of the term unprecedented factors into the headline on the terminal. Israel conducting an unprecedented strike against senior Hamas leaders in the Qatari capital of Doha. Missiles blowing up in Doha earlier today, escalating an already tense standoff between the country and Arab nations over the war in Gaza. We understand that the White House did get a heads up on this shortly before the attack, presumably unable to stop it if there even was an attempt. President Trump was talking about the war in Gaza. And of course, the administration's aim, Israel's aim, to get all hostages released as he made his way to New York on Sunday, speaking with reporters on the tarmac on the way home. Let's listen to the president.
Some things came up having to do with Hamas, etc. And we're working on a solution that maybe could be very good.
Could you tell us what that solution is?
No, but you'll be hearing about it pretty soon. We're trying to get it ended, get the hostages back.
That was 2 days ago. Now buildings are blowing up in Doha. As we add the voice of Aaron David Miller, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, who's joined us more than once since this most recent war in Gaza began. Aaron David Miller, welcome back to Bloomberg. Qatar condemns the strike, calling it a flagrant violation. What would you call it?
Yeah, nothing surprises me anymore. I mean, look what we've witnessed over the last 2 years. October 7, two Israeli strikes on Iran, two Iranian strikes on Israel. The decapitation of Hezbollah's leadership through walkie-talkies and pagers. An American strike against Iranian nuclear sites. The 12-day Iranian-Israeli war. Nothing surprises me. I find this quite consistent, though, with the Netanyahu government's determined policy, not just to destroy and hollow out Hamas as a military organization, but to eliminate its political leadership. And let's be very clear about something. The external leadership, and we don't know who survived and who didn't, but the external leadership, derisively called by some of the insiders as the hotel boys, don't make decisions on hostages, ceasefires. It's the internal military leadership. A brigade commander, Zedine al-Haddad, Gaza City, he appears to be the most preeminent Hamas leader. So I think what the Israelis have done reflects not only what their strategy is, if you could call it that, but it shuts down for the foreseeable future the cutouts that have been used to negotiate an American proposal. And it embarrasses to the extreme a nation.
I think we might have lost Aaron David Miller, and see if we can get him back as we talk about what's happening here in Doha. If you're just joining us, not only did the Qataris condemn the strike as a flagrant violation of international law, they went on to say that Qatar will not tolerate this reckless Israeli behavior and its continued tampering with regional security. That came from the foreign ministry spokesman in a post on X. This is not through sources or those close to the situation. Of course, Hamas leaders who survived the attack may live to see another day here. Aaron David Miller is back with us here from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Aaron, the White House did get a heads up, we understand. Should we presume that the president did nothing to stand in the way of this, or that this White House has no leverage to stop it from happening?
Oh, no. First of all, the White House has tremendous leverage. And this administration, this president has done things. I worked for every administration from Jimmy Carter to Bush 43. I worked and voted for Republicans and Democrats. This president has done things that no other president has done before without Israeli consent. Opened up a direct dialogue with Hamas in March. Cut a deal with the Houthis, about which the Israelis learned after the fact. And opened negotiations with Iran and announced it in the presence of an Israeli prime minister. No, Donald Trump, because of his transactional, me-first nature, in essence does have leverage. It's just like the Biden administration. He has chosen not to impose a single cost or consequence on the Netanyahu government that normal humans would regard as significant or serious pressure. And I, it's hard for me to believe that the Israelis would undertake this without at least a blinking yellow light, if not a green one, from the Trump administration. But we'll see, given the at the next briefing, exactly how the administration comports itself, distances itself, but yet supports it, chooses not to speak at all about this issue. Hard to read right now.
Boy, there's a lot there. And we are going to get a press briefing, by the way, from the White House coming up at the top of the hour at 1 p.m. Eastern time. Qatar is home to the biggest U.S. military base, the biggest air base in the Middle East. Should that not cause concern at the Pentagon, inside the White House, when missiles are flying over or near an American military installation?
Under under normal circumstances, given the realities back here on planet Earth, rather than the realities tethered to a galaxy far, far away? Sure. But remember, the Iranians struck Qatar too in response to the American strike of the three nuclear sites. I mean, yes, for sure. Qatar has, I'm certainly in the eyes of the administration. And remember, you've got the jazzed up, soon to be Air Force One gift from the Qataris to the president. Right. So I think that this administration has a very large part of its heart in the Gulf. Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Qataris with the with the airplane gift. So I suspect that this is where the administration, for any number of reasons, believes it wants to put its focus. And as a consequence, I think the administration will try, and the Qataris will try, to make sure whatever the broken crockery that exists here throughout the region. I'm sure the Arab states now have concluded in their own minds that Israel is a force for instability in the region, not a force for stability. They may have come to that conclusion quite a while ago, but I think the Trump administration and the Qataris will do everything possible to avoid an open break over this. But again, everything's going to turn, I think, on what the administration's reaction is. Because over the last 7 months, it's quite clear to me that the only constraint, the only leverage, Europeans don't wield it, the Arab states don't wield it, the international community has been feckless, divided, disinterested, the UN. Hmm. The only party that conceivably Benjamin Netanyahu pays attention to is Donald Trump and Washington, which is why I think he never would have undertook this without some sense that the administration at least gave the wink and the nod. And one last point, I really do believe, and understandable, I wish Hamas disappeared. I think that the president shares Benjamin Netanyahu's conviction that Hamas needs to be not just undermined militarily, but downgraded to the point of disappearing on the political side.
Just saw a post on Twitter from Senator Lindsey Graham, who just had a very productive and candid meeting, he writes, with my dear friend Ambassador Dermer, referring to Ron Dermer, Israel's Minister of Strategic Affairs, about today's events, he writes, and the way forward in the Middle East writ large. I also spoke, the senator says, with Prime Minister Netanyahu over the phone, who stressed to me his administration, his admiration, rather, for President Trump, calling President Trump's support for Israel historic, unrivaled, and deeply appreciated. There we see Senator Lindsey Graham photographed with Ron Dermer, it appears, in his Capitol office. You served, I believe, Aaron David Miller, in your time at the State Department, 24 years and six secretaries?
Yeah.
You sound a bit despondent today. Is that the right word to describe the way you're feeling?
No. I mean, I've grown used to dealing with uncertainties in this region and keeping my expectations exceedingly low. But the one takeaway I have is that the most important thing that has occurred since October 7th, in my judgment, and one of the reasons we're even having this conversation, Joe, is that the Israelis, State of Israel, has now acquired something that no Israeli government has ever acquired since the creation of the state in 1948. And that is, the fancy term for it is escalation dominance. Israel can determine the pace, the intensity, the focus of their military activities with all of their adversaries, with Iran, with Hamas, with Hezbollah. Houthis provides somewhat of an exception. Israel can escalate in ways that none of their adversaries can. And what you're seeing play out now, remember 2 weeks ago, Israelis struck Sana'a and may have killed a majority of the Houthi cabinet. They killed Ibrahim Haniyeh at a IRGC guest house in Tehran in 2024. Mm-hmm. They've eliminated most of the Hezbollah leadership, including Hassan Nasrallah, and they've killed most of the senior commanders.
Aaron David Miller, I'm sorry we don't have more time, but come back and talk to us. It's always a great pleasure, and we always learn something from you. From the Carnegie Endowment, Aaron David Miller on Bloomberg.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Just 20 minutes from now. That's also, incidentally, when the White House press briefing is set to begin. Caroline Levitt surely loaded for bear today after that letter came out last night. Were you with us on the late edition of Balance of Power, the letter that the president purportedly wrote? Well, it was more of a card on letterhead to Jeffrey Epstein for his birthday. It's part of the big birthday book. And the White House will remind us today, and we should all be aware, that Donald Trump was not the only person in that book, far from, as he reminds us frequently. Bill Clinton was in the book, along with many other heavy hitters from back then. But of course, Donald Trump is the president right now. And he told us that that letter, that note, didn't exist. And now that people are scrutinizing the signature and all the rest of it, it's brought the story back to the front burner here. Remember the name James Walkinshaw? The Democrat from Virginia could be the next member of the House of Representatives and could be the reason why we get one step closer to the release of the Epstein files. There's a discharge petition, as they call it, and they're two votes short. This would force, if assuming it passed, the release of the Epstein files. And if they're too short, well, we got one, it looks like, today. There's a special election happening in Virginia to fill the seat of the late Jerry Connally. This is Virginia's 11th congressional district, and it will not be a surprise when a Democrat wins, okay? That's the Democrat named James Walkinshaw. Then there's another special in Arizona later this month. Leans Democratic. That's all the votes they would need, Tom Massey and Ro Khanna, to get this to the floor. So big questions about the way this is all going to work right now. And Mike Johnson continuing to hear about this as well, the Speaker of the House. This is where we start with our panel today. Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano back together again. Bloomberg Politics contributors. Jeannie is Democracy Visiting Fellow at Harvard Kennedy School's Ash Center. And Rick is our Republican strategist partner at Stone Court Capital. So, Jeannie, it is the Democrats who are going to push this over the line. What do you think?
They could, and you're right. The election today in the 11th in Virginia, followed by the special in Arizona. And of course, Democrats have been overperforming in special elections. Certainly, it would be stunning if they lost in the 11th. They could also win in Arizona, which would give the Democrats and also Tom Massey and Marjorie Taylor Greene and those Republicans who support it the votes they need to get this over, this discharge petition over the line. Of course, then they come to the wall that is the Senate, and we have seen no appetite from John Thune to push this forward, which is why so much of the public outcry about this and the, I think in particular, the really impactful statements by the victims the other day. Those kinds of things are the kind of things that may break this impasse, but, you know, they still have an uphill battle here.
What do you think about this, Rick, in the upper chamber where you spent much of your career? If this discharge petition hits the House floor and passes, what happens next door? Does it die in the U.S. Senate?
Yeah, I think it ultimately will not see the light of day in the Senate. You don't seem to have the rigorous debate going on there about release of these records that you've had really for months now in the House of Representatives. The Republicans in the Senate have kind of kept their own counsel on this, waiting to see what happens. And they don't tend to play to the crowd as much as the House does. So this is definitely a populist, you know, feed the MAGA beast issue. Nobody else in America really cares about this kind of stuff. And so it's a little bit like self-immolation in the House, right? I mean, like, they know this is not good for their electoral chances. It's taken a lot of attention away from talking about the economy and things that voters care about. And they're not promoting the big, beautiful bill, which is what they claim they're going to run on. You know, and so it's just a massive distraction. And yet you're right. I mean, I think framing these special elections in the context of the biggest vote they have coming up, which is, you know, this Epstein Files vote, is a good way to do it. And today in the 11th district, I would add old friend, my old friend, I can't remember anymore, was Congressman Republican from there. Yeah. And for a long time. And yet this has been a reliably Democratic district now, certainly throughout Connally's time. And everybody I know in Virginia is expecting this to be retaken by the Democrat. So my guess is you're right. This is one vote closer to a discharge petition. And that's what we're going to be talking about for the rest of the week.
Tom Davis, right? Did James
Tom
get
Davis.
It? Is that who it was?
Great
there
guy.
You go. Wow, that was going to bother me.
My close friend.
Okay, so, well, yeah, that's with all of that said here, Jeannie, if this passes muster with a discharge petition and dies in the Senate, does that stop the conversation? Because you've got one chamber of Congress here that thinks it should be released.
Yeah, some members of one chamber. I don't think it stops the conversation, and here's why. I agree with Rick to the extent that this is not on the top of people's minds, and really the focus is on, should be on, the things they care about, jobs, economy, inflation, and the like. The problem here for Donald Trump is that he is not only, by many people's account, blatantly lying about the signature, which you can, you know, just look and believe your own eyes when you see it. But the reality is that he ran saying that he was going to take down the very type of elites that are all over, to your earlier point, this book, everyone from Bill Gates and Bill Clinton, and the list goes on and on, Alan Dershowitz. He bought into the narrative from the right that there is this cabal of elites and we are going to dismantle them. And now he is unwilling to open these files. Why? There's no evidence he was engaged in a crime, but the reality is he was friendly with these folks. He was one of them before he decided that he would join the far right and stand up against them. So this is not something that is likely going to die unless Donald Trump pulls the Band-Aid. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't have really any, we don't get a sense he's willing to do that. The other thing I would watch for is Robert Garcia. There's some tension between James Comer, the chair, and the ranking member Robert Garcia in oversight. And what was fascinating to me, Robert Garcia, new to the committee in leadership on the committee on the minority side, he said, this is a new way of doing business. You know, that the old folks on the oversight, they're stuck in the past. We're taking a new approach here. And he released the document before the committee did yesterday. And I think that is what we're in store for. And what's he responding to? The base of the Democratic Party, which is saying, you can't play by the old rules anymore. We are in a new world. He talked about a new generation and new forms of oversight. So pay attention to that, not just about the Epstein story, but about so much else going on in the House today.
It's really interesting, especially on that committee. Speaking of new rules, Rick, we're going to be hearing from the White House imminently here. This is a press briefing first. I'm sure Caroline Leavitt will have a lot to say, and she'll certainly be asked about this, whether or not she opens with it. And the president himself has a couple of events today, one of them right up against the late edition of Balance of Power. We could be hearing from him right around 5 p.m., and surely he'll be talking about this or trying to move the conversation away from it, but we'll be cognizant of this whole story emerging today. We've heard a lot from the president about other people in that book, and I wonder if we're being fair, to be honest with you, Rick. Bill Clinton is in that book, as I mentioned, talking about Jeffrey Epstein's childlike wonder in the letter that he wrote. Peter Mandelson, UK ambassador to Washington, in there as well. His spokesman last night had to talk about, once again, the regret that he feels of ever knowing Jeffrey Epstein. Does it help Donald Trump that he's one of dozens of people in this book?
You know, I think that it's a little bit like what Jeannie was saying. Donald Trump stands out because his claim was, I'm not one of those people, right? I mean, like, yeah, right. The rest of them aren't distancing themselves from each other. They're distancing themselves from Epstein. Trump's trying to do something that's quite unique, which is distance himself from Epstein and everybody else in the book, is close to any kind of list of friends we've been talking about with regard to Jeffrey Epstein. So, and today he's saying, well, you know, this is a dead issue. I declare it dead. He's the worst one at declaring anything dead because he brings it up all the time. He talked about this all throughout the campaign and how he was going to make, you know, put light on this issue. And it's really an issue concocted by MAGA to stir up the base. And now it's coming back to bite the leadership. And I wouldn't be surprised, like you, that he can't discipline himself and claim it's a dead issue and goes right into it and sort of defends his position and claims none of this stuff is real.
J.D. Vance, the vice president on Twitter, Jeannie, Democrats don't care about Epstein. They don't even care about his victims. And we've heard Republicans say that on this program. That's why they were silent about it for years. The only thing they care about is concocting another fake scandal like Russiagate to smear President Trump with lies. No one is falling for this BS. That was his response to the letter that went public last evening. I've been hearing that a lot, that Democrats don't care about the victims. They're simply trying to hang this around the neck of the president. What should be Democrats' response, knowing that this could have been addressed years ago?
It should be, we're so glad you're supportive of the victims, Vice President. Release the files as they have requested. That's it. That's all they have to say. I'm not sure. You know, this is where the Republicans are like really trying to claw out of a problem. Even if that's the case, Democrats don't care at all. Why don't you care enough to do what the victims are asking so that they can get closure, many of whom can't even recall giving the amount of PTSD they have experienced, how they are referenced in these files. They haven't seen them. They're asking to. If that's the case, Mr. Vice President, please, by all means, show your support and release the files. That's it. And so, you know, J.D. Vance, his Twitter has been fascinating to me, by the way, whether it's on the Venezuela boat thing or anything else these days. But it doesn't seem to help their cause. And on the Bill Clinton letter, Joe, if you can tell me what that letter meant, I will pay you. I don't have $1 million, but something, Joe, because I tried to make sense of it. It was nonsensical to me. And I don't, maybe it's just me. I'm not in that mindset, and nor do I want to be, but I couldn't make any sense of that birthday note.
I would not think you are, nor Rick Davis, for that matter. Yeah, it's quite the rogues gallery and quite the read. Jeannie, thank you. And Rick Davis for humoring us in this conversation that apparently will not be ending anytime soon and may well continue a little bit later on at the White House. We've also got the matter of this massive BLS downward revision that I suspect the White House does want to talk about and the president will shine a light on here as a justification, based at least on the statement that they issued earlier on this record revision, a justification of President Trump's firing of the BLS commissioner. Rick Davis and Jeannie Shanzano, Bloomberg Politics contributors, and only on Balance of Power.
Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.